22, put on fire. Go ahead, Mike. Roger that, thank you, Dick. Yeah, I went down to Wallops last week or week before last. Spent a week down there. There's a class that they do for mostly college students and college professors. It's called Rock On. There's three classes, Rock On, Roxat X, and Roxat C, where you build a bunch of students and professors get together and build payloads. And basically you put them up in a sounding rocket, and you get your data back. It's a week-long project. We shot up a Carrier Orion rocket, went up to 118 kilometers. The edge of space is 100 kilometers. And that's, you know, I can go on quite a bit. I don't know how long you want me to talk. Over to you, Dick, K1MJM.
I do want to hear more. Was there photography on that rocket? I bet there was. I bet it took photography either live or recovered later. Also, I'm listening to you on the input. I'm listening to the 2585 machine. You're really potent tonight. Either we're getting very good propagation, or you're running more watts, or you've got more antenna. You made some kind of an improvement, Mike. So tell us about your improvement. Tell us whether or not that rocket took pictures. I bet those students were really excited. It sounds to me like you were there at the right time to watch this live. K1MJM, K2LIW.
Roger that, Dick. Yeah, I'm in Milford, Connecticut tonight. I'm usually in trouble, but I'm at my workshop working on a little project here. I have a little shop that I rent. And I put up a 36-foot temporary tower so I could listen to your tech net here. So, yeah, I have a little bit better antenna, a little more powerful antenna than I usually have. As far as the project goes, I took it as a student last year, and I worked it as an instructor, an assistant instructor this year. I did send both yourself and John, along with Paul, I sent all you guys links to my little link on the website there, and YouTube. Let me drop it. NASA takes a lot of pictures. They put it on their website. You can go onto the NASA website and search Rock On Carrier Orion launch, June 26th, I believe it was. If you do a search on the NASA website, you can get their photography. A bunch of my pictures are on the, I actually put them on this Limark TechNet website on the space page. At the bottom of the page, there's a link, so you can get there that way. And I put my video on YouTube. I believe Paul found the NASA video on YouTube also. Is that correct, Paul?
Yes, it was. It was long, but final it made. I got to see the mission control. Got to see the blow of the launch. I'm not going to call it gantry, but they saw lowering it, lowering that. It was very, very cool. Back to you, Mike.
I seem to remember that it has a hydraulic piston that raises that launching structure. Looks like it was very well designed. And this, if I understand correctly, a student-constructed thing that went to over 100 kilometers into space. Did it have a camera on board? And I'll bet you it had some exciting pictures if it did. Over to you, Mike.
For my group, this is K1MJM. For my group, the Rock On group, which is the earliest, the lowest class for all intents and purposes, Roxat C is the next one up, and Roxat X is the high-end one. We did not have a camera. We had a bunch of accelerometers, low, medium, high G accelerometers, gyros, Geiger counters, pressure sensors, temperatures, all that kind of stuff, and microprocessor. We had 65 students in our class, and they were broken down into groups of 3 and 4, and each group built their own sensor package. We put them in canisters and we put them on the rocket, and that went up. After it landed, after it splashed down in the ocean, I don't know, a couple hours later, they picked it up and brought it back. Let me let it drop.
I'll bet that was a parachute landing so that it didn't get damaged. And if you get a chance, please tell us what you believe was the maximum acceleration. How many G's of acceleration did the accelerometer see? Back to you, Mike.
Both last year and this year, we had around 40 G's in vertical acceleration. Also, it's a spin-stabilized rocket, so we get a lot of gyro effect and horizontal acceleration through the panel where your accelerometer is. The movie, the video, it's kind of, you know, if you watch it on a big screen, it'll turn your stomach because it's spinning at about 4 to 6 RPM. Back over to you, Daniel.
40 G's. That is a lot by my standards. I think a human being can barely take 9, and most likely will black out unless you've got a high G suit on at the time. 40 G's, I think that's life-threatening if it was a human being. What was the propellant? Is that a solid rocket engine? And, my goodness, and how many pounds of thrust? I think we're talking about some pretty big numbers here, Mike, aren't we? K1MJM, K2LIW, and the tech man.
Mike, you got to tell them the diameter of these things. I read that.
I think the outer diameter of a rocket is somewhere around 20 inches. Does that sound right, Paul?
I saw it in kilometers, but I came out with 18 inches diameter, and the Orion second stage was 14. It's a big thing. I mean, I couldn't believe it. Back to you, Mike.
So what is the propellant, and how many pounds of thrust are you getting to take the weight of that rocket and give you 40 G's of acceleration? That's a lot of Newton meters per second squared, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Mike.
Roger that, Dick. They didn't actually tell us what the thrust was. The thrust actually varies as to what kind of charge they put in it. Yes, it is a solid fuel propellant. Carrier Orion is actually an interceptor. It was an aircraft and rocket, you know, missile interceptor left over from the late 60s. So these are all surplus rockets. It hits Mach 1 in a few seconds. But the rocket is so loud that you can't hear the sonic boom with all the reflected noise off the ground and the buildings and stuff. And we were 400 yards away when it launches.
I bet you took some motion pictures of that launch. In fact, I did see the video of that launch, as I remember, or at least one of those launches. And boy, it leaves that very white light trail against the blue sky. And that thing is really booking, as they say. It's moving. And so, Mach 1 in a couple of seconds. Got a guess as to what's the maximum Mach number it hit them. And either give us to us in meters per second, thousands of miles an hour, or Mach number. Your choice, Mike. K1MJM, K2RIW.
Dick, I'm sorry, I don't have that number. I did need to figure it out. I do have the data, and I can figure it out, but I did not figure it out yet. After it hits that 40 G's, it kind of drops down to around the mid-20s, and it holds that for a while. When the second stage goes off, it's a pretty impressive shock again. As a matter of fact, when the first stage is falling, it's like several minutes later the first stage is falling, you can hear the second stage, the first stage, fall, the sonic boom, as it passes before it splashes down into the water. I didn't do the calculation. I wish I had. I knew somebody was going to ask me that. Sorry.
Now, quite often when I'm giving my mini lectures on antennas, feed lines, propagation, or whatever, I say that, hey, with proper training, these things are quite learnable. It is not rocket science. All of a sudden, I realize, hey, these students are learning rocket science. So should we say it's not rocket science, or rocket science is learnable if you've got the right instructor? Give us some words on this one, Mike. K1MJM, K2LIW.
Our class was mostly on the sensor systems and interfaces to the rocket and all the requirements. We didn't get into the thrust, and we did get a little lesson on the spin stabilization and accelerations and all that kind of stuff. But most of our training and learning was all about the sensors and interfaces to the rocket, as the K1MJM.
To make that rocket fly straight, is that gyroscopically stabilized? Where is the, to put it in pigeon German, where's the Stargage and Sternberg? What makes it fly straight, Mike? Go ahead.
Normally, they would control the fins, the fins on the tail end there, to steer it. In this particular case, because they try to keep the price down, the cost down, and it is a sounding rocket. Sounding rockets, they try to keep the price but the cost down. They spin the rocket. They put a little bit of angle on those tail fins there so the thing spins at 4 to 6 RPM, and that keeps it straight. That launch rail, they put up a sounding balloon every maybe every 10 or 15 minutes to make sure they can track the wind, and then they point the rocket in just the right direction, and then they let the thing go. But it stabilizes, it's kept straight by spinning at 4 to 6 RPM, and that keeps it in line.
So you're saying there's nothing else to make it go straight up? If it wanted to curve off to one side because of the continuous rotation, that would end up as a kind of spiral, but therefore it would still have the launch direction that you've given it as it leaves the rail. Fantastic. And I'm amazed that it gets enough velocity off that launch rail soon enough that those tail fins take over before you get a chance to flop over at some other angle. So in the case of the space shuttle, for instance, you've got these hold-down chocks that hold the whole craft down until you measure the right amount of thrust. In other words, you know your liquid engine is firing, giving you the right thrust. And when you achieve that number, you you light up the solid rocket boosters, and then you let go of it. So when you finally let go of the space shuttle, it's giving you 6.5 million pounds of thrust on a 4 million pound vehicle, and you know it's going to move. Do they do something similar on the launch of these particular rockets, Mike, K1MJM, K2RIW?
Negative, Dick. That solid propellant booster there, it's kind of more like an explosion than a regular rocket engine. If you watch the video, you'll understand. It goes off like a fireworks rocket. It's not like a shuttle launch. That thing ignites, and flames and smoke shoots everywhere, and dirt is just flying everywhere. It really is an explosion, not an acceleration like you'd normally think of a rocket. It's very exciting.
That solid rocket booster gives you thrust for roughly what length of time? Is it like 10 seconds of thrust for the first stage and maybe another 10 seconds of thrust for the second stage? Am I at least in the right ballpark here, Mike, go ahead?
I thought it was long, Mike, right?
What was that, Paul?
From watching on the screen, it looked like a long period of time. That thing didn't go off. It went on and on, and then eventually the second stage went on. But it seemed like a long period of time that thing was firing.
Roger that, yeah. And it's amazing that the rocket, the diameter is so small, but it does last for such a long time. When you're up close and you see how much thrust and noise and energy comes out of it, you just wouldn't think that much power could be contained in that little fuselage. It's probably 15 seconds or more for the first stage, and then probably a little bit more than that for the second stage.
And if you hit Mach 1 in the first couple of seconds, the 15 seconds of thrust, a peak of 40 Gs and a valley of 20 Gs seconds on the first stage, and then another stage for 15 seconds, I think we're getting up to some pretty good velocities here, Mike. I'm hearing a sound of Mach 10, Mach 15. Is that possible? What do you think?
It's probably not quite that high, but it's upwards of there. Like I said, it is an interceptor. It was the Navy's equivalent to a Nike missile. It was made to intercept aircraft and rockets, ICBMs and stuff like that. So it does have to be very fast.
So I think you're saying that the basic booster is part of a known United States weapons system. Is that approximately what's going on here, Mike?
That's what I read, Dick.
Roger that, Dick. Both the booster and the rocket itself are both surplus from the late 60s, early 70s. and they have a lot of these things around rather than try to dispose of them. They came to an agreement, whatever the international agreement for reduction in arms. They became sounding rockets for research, atmospheric research, and that kind of stuff. So instead of throwing them away and destroying them, they went to NASA for research use.
Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that what I read was the Terriers came out of the Army. I think it was the Army, and the Orions came out of the Navy. That's the way I read it in one of the articles. It was a separate article. I was reading through the Rock On group, all the different things that they're involved in.
And the thing that I'm curious, along these lines, and what Mike and what Paul is asking you, is the solid rocket booster propellant, I thought, has a date code on it. In other words, you've got to use it by a certain date, otherwise you can't guarantee its performance. If, for instance, it develops cracks in the wrong places, you can get an overpressure. So if this is surplus equipment from many years ago, is it being reloaded with fresh solid rocket fuel? Or is by some magic solid rocket fuel being preserved way beyond the usual use-by date? K1MJM, K2LIW.
From what they told us, they do have different charges. You can get slightly different charges. There are different propellant types and things like that, or I should say types, different burn rates and things for different types of applications. But yes, it is left over. It does have a date code for use on board ships and in missile silos. They do a test. They do a visual and some kind of chemical test on it to see if it's still good. And safe to use. Let me let it drop and I'll continue. If you notice, some of the bigger sounding rockets, they have the lower half or lower two-thirds of the rocket is a yellow. It's all bright yellow. Those particular rockets are nitroglycerin-based propellants that are left over from the Cold War, from the 60s. And those have been stored at 72 degrees for many, many years since then. And they don't know what will happen if the temperature changes. So when they put them in the launch pad, that yellow is a temperature-controlled wrap that they maintain at 72 degrees. And when it launches, that wrap blows away. But from the 60s until now, that thing's been kept at 72 degrees.
Fantastic. Now, when you get that high above the atmosphere, above 100 kilometers, you're essentially in space. You're above, I'm going to pick a number, 99% of the atmosphere. Then, for the first time, you can really directly see cosmic rays and the solar wind and whatever, whereas cosmic rays that we see down here on the Earth are really secondary cosmic rays. They hit something in the Earth's atmosphere, and now you're seeing the scatter of all that stuff. Whereas at those altitudes, you can now look at cosmic rays, solar wind, X-rays from the sun, and whatever, directly. So have any of these sounding rockets had that kind of instrumentation on board, to your knowledge, Mike? K1MJM, K2LIW?
Our rocket had a Geiger, each of our projects had a Geiger counter on it. Most of the projects, the more advanced classes, they do monitor many of those things. Like I said, ours just had a Geiger counter on it, and our Geiger counter goes crazy once it gets up into the ionosphere and, the lower ionosphere and then higher. So, yes, many of these rockets do monitor that, and I believe NASA sends them up regularly to look at those kind of things. K1MJM.
Let's see if anyone else has any rocket questions for Mike while we got him on frequency. Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the tech net.
Extend for both of the gentlemen.
One comment. Well, one thing I wanted to tell you that I read about these rockets, about the altitude thing.
Go ahead, Paul, and then we'll go over to Wes. You got a poll.
One of the advantages of these rockets is that you can take, for instance, balloons, and they'll only go up to maybe 25 miles tops. That's it. So whatever kind of test equipment you're bringing up, that's about as all you're going to get. Then you can take satellites in orbit, and usually the lowest altitude that you're going to be able to use a satellite before it's about to decay. Its orbit is 75 miles. I mean, you're really pushing it. So between this 25 and 75 mile range, these sounding rockets really do the job. You know, they can go quite high. And in fact, one of the, probably the big one Mike was talking about, that you can have a payload up to 900 pounds, so you can bring up some heavy-duty equipment for testing. Back to you, Dick.
A satellite that is only 75 miles from the surface of the Earth, I think, only has a duration of one day before it comes back into the atmosphere. You're going to experience an awful lot of drag. Isn't that the, roughly the lifetime of the kind of altitude the pole has?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, you bare minimum would be 75, 80 miles, but these sounding rockets could go that height. They could go to, you know, the 100 mile height. So they'll cover the areas that the balloons and the orbital satellites can't. Back to that.
And there was a balloon flight by which I can't think of the guy's name in the last few months. He did jump out of the balloon at something like 110,000 feet. And as he fell through the very thin atmosphere, he exceeded the speed of sound as a human being falling before deploying the parachute. What a project. Let's go ahead with your question for Paul. N2XJM, K2LIW.
I have a question for both of the gentlemen. But first, let me make a comment about the Mars flying saucers that were stuck on in parachutes. It was imagined to be controllable failure, so it was a failure at all means. Now the question about rockets. In 1981, Shuttle Columbia was the first shuttle orbiter that was launched into the orbit. In 1988, Buran, B-U-R-A-N, was sent as an unmanned spacecraft, which was actually the shuttle in full scale, and it came back. But after that, in 1993, because of the falling down Soviet Union, the program was stopped. And sometime after that, America decided that for the military satellite, they're going to use Russian rockets. It would be rocket engines, so RD-180 engine was used by the American military satellite, and that was due to the United Launch Alliance, ULA, that was leading to Energomash, Russian, and United Technologies Corporation. And because of the sanction, right now they cannot use it any longer, and there is a suspicion that NASA will have a problem to launch them. My question is, if Russia was having a problem with production of their rocket engines, which one of the best one was the Buran that was produced, and based on that, the same concept was used for those military rockets that were also foreseen by NASA as a launch mechanism. Who is actually the one that suffers? Who is the one who is not capable of building a proper engine? Russia doesn't have the money to do so, but is doing so for Americans. Americans who doesn't have the money for their own, and they use Russian, but they cannot use Russian right now because of the politics. I mean, what is the future? And to FGM.
You got it, Paul. And as I see it, some of these commercial launches seem to be doing very well from the words you've been giving us for the last few weeks. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, It's WS going. You got to watch the news media. The RS-180 is primarily used on the Atlas rockets, which we have a whole bunch of them stored. I mean, we'd have to be fighting with the Russians for probably the next 4 to 5 years before we run out of rockets. The United Alliance truly consists of Boeing and Lockheed. They got a lock on that. It's called the United Alliance Launch. They are the ones that actually compete against private companies like SpaceX. So their primary rocket that they use is built by the Russians. But don't forget, we have the Delta rockets. Delta rockets are the ones that launched Spirit and Opportunity to Mars. True, the Atlas launched the Curiosity to Mars. But Delta has launched many, many rockets. And they are not the Russian ones. The Space Launch System being built by NASA, which is going to send people eventually to Mars and beyond. On the RS-25s, they are shuttle engines. You look at the back, there are three main shuttle engines. They have a 25, and what we're going to be using now in that design with about 25% more horsepower for each one, because they've been upgraded for the Space Launch System, and there's going to be four on the back of the Space Launch System, not three, plus the two booster rockets. So we don't have any problems with future launches. And then, like Dick said, the commercial outfit, you've got the launch coming up this Friday by Orbital Science from Wallops Island, sending the Cygnus up to the International Space Station. Chicago being launched with an Orbital Science built a rocket called Antares. It was actually just two cones sticking out. That has nothing to do with the Russians when we drop it. Same with SpaceX. Their Merlin rocket. They call them the Falcon 9. The Falcon 9 is the main rocket that takes up Dragon X or the payloads for the commercial outfits. The Falcon 9 consists of 9 Merlin rockets. So Merlin rocket is built by USA, built by SpaceX. Even the second stage is a Merlin rocket that qualifies to operate under vacuum, because that's up and out of space when that thing comes on. So we don't have any problem. I mean, it's going to cause a little problem for Launch Alliance with Boeing and Lockheed because of the possible eventual shortage of the Russian rockets for the Atlas rockets. But I'm not too concerned. Back to you, Dick, WS plan.
It sounds like there's a lot of capability there. When we abandoned the space shuttle, at first a lot of Americans thought that, you've got nothing. But I'm now hearing the sound of an awful lot of alternate procedures for launching things into space. It'd be nice to dream about having a space elevator, but I can see a bunch of reasons why that's not going to become a reality for some time. But now a lot of these things are really being tested by being launched to the International Space Station. One of the things that I did a week or two ago on the job is that if you Google the word International Space Station plus Wikipedia, look at the Wikipedia presentation on International Space Station. You see a whole bunch of beautiful blow-up diagrams, and now for the first time, you see all those names of all those modules that Paul has been telling us about for the last 4 years or so. And so you see their arrangement, the size of the thing. I think from tip to tip with the solar cells, I think it's something like 303 feet wide, almost 300 feet high, and something like 0.9 million pounds total is what the International Space Station is. A lot of hardware. And when you look at some of these YouTube videos, let me drop this. There are a number of YouTube-like videos of where various astronauts will give you a tour of the International Space Station. They'll have a guy with a camera literally fly, so to speak, behind the astronauts that's giving you the explanation. We're now passing the so-and-so module. Look over here, you'll see the such-and-such. And you see them literally flying from end to end on this great big structure. Boy, there's a lot of cubic feet they've got in space. And so I'm pretty sure you've seen, I'm sure you have seen these YouTube videos of, you've seen the Wikipedia presentation of International Space Station. From my point of view, they do an awfully good job. What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
They got 100%. An A plus, no question about it. That's tour. I mean, a lot of the astronauts have given the tour. Best one is by Suni Williams, S-U-N-I Williams. She was commander of the International Space Station for a while. And she gave it to her a day or two before she was coming back home. Best one by far. I mean, it shows you the sleeping arrangements, everything. She's terrific. No question about it. Google that one. Suni Williams, International Space Station tour. Okay, and all the modules. All the trusses, each piece that was brought up by the space station, by the shuttle. Some of the websites, I don't know if it's Wikipedia, it probably is. They'll give you the order in which they were brought up there. Actually, there.
I was very lucky. I did see the Suni Williams, and I think there's a Suni Williams 1 and 2. I think she made two separate versions the day before she was about to come back home. And like you said, she covers the Japanese section, the American section, the German section, so to speak. And of course, the most frequent question that the astronauts get by youngsters is, tell us about the bathroom. Tell us how that works. And so she gave us a pretty good description of how it all works.
It's only 10 minutes left. Even 8 minutes left. I was about to go to my session.
Okay, you got it.
It's not much. It's going to be entertaining. Toyota announced that by 2015, they will have a car that emits only the water vapor. Remember, there was some time ago when I pointed at the number of YouTubes talking about HHO, which is being able to split the water to gases. This one is pretty close, not exactly what it is, but what do you say? Is that from one tank of no gasoline at all, the Toyota will have a range of 300 miles. It will reach from 0 to 60 miles per hour in 10 seconds, and it will refuel in 5 minutes. Enter here.
Is that an electric vehicle you just described? That it can be refueled in that amount of time, 200 miles of range, 0 to 60, and I think you said 10 seconds. Is that an electric vehicle that's on the way?
That is correct. So, gasoline component of the water will be converted with the use of the fuel, and the electric car will use the electric motors that will be powered with the electrical energy out of them. So, the electric car, which Toyota calls F, he uses hydrogen as a fuel for the battery. And they will have about 10,000 vehicles, if I understand properly, in 2015, in American roads. They will be mostly targeting San Francisco and San Diego. In California at first, and the car will probably cost about $50,000, depends on the model, up to $100,000. Enter it here.
Now, in the past, electric vehicles, battery-powered vehicles, had great difficulty getting beyond, say, 75 miles, even 100 miles. If this Toyota vehicle has a range of 200 miles, what is the breakthrough that allowed that to happen, Wes? Go ahead.
It's at 300 miles, and acceleration is 10 seconds to each of the miles per hour. My understanding is that hydrogen is powering the electric motor, so it will be. Electric motor is creating direct energy, no batteries. Then the direct energy is being utilized by the electric motor, the DC motor. Enter the ship.
Okay, so I think you're saying that the fuel is compressed hydrogen, so it sounds like. That as a fuel allows you to have 300 miles of range, reasonable acceleration. I'm wondering why it takes 15 minutes to refuel that vehicle. Maybe it's because you're not exchanging tanks. You're pouring either gaseous or liquid hydrogen from the so-called gas station into the tank. Is that approximately what's happening here? And will California have enough distribution centers, in other words, enough gas stations, for this to be convenient? We've got a little bit of a rabbit, a chicken-egg problem here. It's difficult to buy a hydrogen-powered vehicle if you don't have hydrogen-equipped gas stations. And you're not going to install a lot of hydrogen-equipped gas stations if there's not a lot of hydrogen-equipped vehicles that are going to be using it. And 2XJN, K2LIW.
Actually, if you think time is 5 minutes, thing is that you can buy anywhere from $60 to $300 hydrogen generators on eBay. Not a big deal right now, used one. They will invest about $200 million to build about 20 fueling stations by 2015. So my understanding is that by 2015, there would be the infrastructure that would support about 10,000 of vehicles that would be sold in 2015, till the end of 2016. And about 100,000 of vehicles that would be on the road by year 2016. So my understanding is, but it says $200 million to build a 20 fueling stations by 2015, 40 by 2016, and 100 of the stations by 2024. And
the hydrogen generators that can be bought on eBay today, do they operate by way of electrolysis? And is the intention to have a hydrogen generator in your home, gathering hydrogen, putting it into a tank, that in turn, you dump that into your automobile periodically, and that when your automobile is completely filled with hydrogen, I think you're telling me it has roughly 300 miles of range. That particular fueling procedure, where if it is electrolysis, I'm now taking Con Ed electrical power or LIPA electrical power, so to speak, and I'm converting that into hydrogen, and the hydrogen is now powering my vehicle. Is that overall process cheaper, more expensive, or almost identical to buying gasoline and getting similar range on a gasoline-powered automobile? And 2XJN, K2LIW?
No, absolutely nothing electrolytic. Ultrasonic electrolysis or vibrational production of the hydrogen is the most common one. When you're creating when the diffraction of the gases from the air, which air is actually the medium that we extract all the necessary gases for it, you could use various numbers of techniques. And one of them is a simple tube, could be made from plastic and PCV and with a hose, and there is a filter in it. And nitrogen is more heavy, so it tends to stay in the tube if your target is nitrogen. And the rest of the gases would actually go on the side of that filter, so it would be something that is long about 3 feet whatsoever. It's one of the techniques. But of course, you can have additional mechanisms in order for you to separate the other gases and have them. The tank that I have right now is 250-liter tank, and it's primarily made for hydrogen, but could handle without any problem. It is made for, for nitrogen, but it's made for hydrogen and argon if you want to. So that's not a big deal. Enter a share. 2 minutes, please.
Yeah, thank you, John. If I'm going to separate hydrogen from the atmosphere, I see a problem. The atmosphere in your house and my house is close to 20% N2, close to 20% O2, close to 80% N2. It's an extremely small amount of hydrogen in the atmosphere. So if I'm going to use atmospheric separation of hydrogen, and if there's so little there, I'm wondering how this process works with N2XJN, K2LIW.
When you have a piezoelectric B-mode cantilever with the vibrational plate that is producing hydrogen, you actually have a piezoelectric B-mode force that could use the air, but could use also the water if you want to. It's up to you. And that would be sort of the electrolysis. That would be a piezochemical hydrogen production if you do it from water. But the much more simpler way to do it is from the air. When you do it from water, then the output will be the hydrogen and oxygen through the application of mechanical vibration, and that would be somewhere at the frequency of 46.2 hertz. Enter XGM.
The hydrogen-oxygen bond in water molecules is a very strong bond, and so you have to put a lot of energy into electrolysis to separate them. I think you're telling me that an ultrasonic process by which I physically agitate water allows me to separate hydrogen from oxygen, and is that a more efficient process? I mean, since I'm breaking the exact same bond, and it's a strong bond, it would appear as though I'd have to put the same amount of energy in there to break that hydrogen-oxygen bond. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Actually, I was looking at those devices, and I was about to buy for $35 a hydrogen generator by mistake, because it was sale as a nitrogen generator, and it was oxygen generator. So plenty of this stuff is right now available, that would surprise me. Some of them operate in 10 watts region. Some of them operate in 100 watts. Most of them operate in 200 watts region. Interesting.
Yeah, I noticed that the Ethernet input is off again. I tried restoring it, no luck. The 10 watts, 100 watts. If I'm using a air agitator, is what I think it is, an ultrasonic vibrator, in order to either separate hydrogen from oxygen in water, or by some means separating it from air, do you have any idea at the 100 watt level, how fast do I gather a hydrogen by that process of West N2XJN, K2LIW?
That I'm not sure, because I was mostly concentrating myself on the nitrogen. The vibrational devices to produce nitrogen were about at the level of the energy of 200 watts were about 600 cubic meters per minute. So it's quite a big number. But it was a gaseous one, was not a liquid one. As far as the other guys, I'm not sure. Interesting.
Yeah, for those who Google N2XJN, Wes's website on QRZ.com, I said Google it, but you go to QRZ.com and dial in N2XJN, you'll see a bunch of photographs of some of the recently acquired instrumentation and hardware that Wes has. He's assembling a very significant laboratory that can do research as to what are the components of a compound. I mean, spectral analysis, things like that. So, is your laboratory 80% complete, or are you still gathering instrumentation and hardware, Wes? I'm seeing some very significant hardware there. N2XJN, K2LIW.
I didn't put them on my web, on ANZXGN, it's a place for me, I gotta check it out. But I sent you the information, you, Roy, and John. I sent those photographs. Yes, it is quite expensive. I'm getting a lot of help from scientific community. I'm getting the information where something is got to be taken because they don't know what to do with it. I'm buying some from the auctions, and the price is absolutely unbelievable. I'm going to give you one example.
12:05 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2BL repeater.
Oh, that's an awful nice price. Okay, the machine has been turned off. I can only get through by way of the Eastern input. You guys have just listened to technique number 1513 of the series. John and I, and 2XJN, and Wes, and Paul, the new S2N. We intend to be back next week. We'll settle a few more of these things, but we'll never have it all settled. More to follow. Bye bye, you all. Be kind to each other. And I wonder if you have some closing comments, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John. Okay, be back. Bye-bye, you all. And try to be kind to each other. This is a hobby. You're doing this for fun. Don't take it too serious. And in the big picture, you're not going to get out of this one alive. You better enjoy the process. Bye-bye for now.
Good night, all. Great net. K2UPS mobile.
There's a man who's got good taste. Bye-bye, Rich. Out of curiosity, are you going to be at the luncheon on Friday? My guess is you're going to be pretty busy. Is that true, Rich?
I might make it there this Friday. The following Friday, I'll be in Connecticut for the convention, but I'll try to make it there this Friday.
Very good. I'm going to try to make it also. Bye-bye for now. K2RAW clear. Mike, did you just call me? I'm hearing you on the input. Go ahead, K1MJM, K2RAW. Okay, Week Signal Picnic is this Saturday. How about that? And that's probably going to be held in, I can't think of the name of the town, right at the border of Connecticut and Massachusetts on Route 91. Is that true? Okay, thank you for bringing that to my attention. And whether or not I'm going to be able to make it, I don't know, but we'll see. Okay. Bye-bye for now, and keep up the good work, Mike. K1XJM for the final. K2RIW listening.
tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club Repeater System, code number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club Repeater System, node number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link active.
But I found out that I needed to make repairs to the trailer lights, which had self-destructed from saltwater incursion.
Ah, no bueno. It's a boat trailer with kind of waterproof the trailer lights.
Well, lights are submersible if you buy the submersible types, you know. If they do get old and they do fail, they use a bell jar design so that the water doesn't get up into the light. But once you get old and tired and you no longer have the bell jar effect, the water gets in there.
You have to change the whole light itself, bell jar, the whole thing.
I replaced the two lights, repaired one of the running lights, the marker lights up front, and added extra ground wires throughout the length of the trailer back to the lighting assembly. So, and put a new connector on it. So, wasn't that big a deal, just that I had to go run over to Freeport Marine to pick up the set of lights.
And by the time you went over to Freeport Marine, went back to your house, and pulled everything, had to go out on the water, I think.
I could have gone out on the water if I wanted to, but the sun was already coming down, and I didn't think a moonlight cruise was warranted, so to heck with it. So we went out yesterday instead, which proved to be a lot more adventurous than going out on Saturday, late afternoon when the wind died down and it got real flat and calm. So we got soaking wet, got bounced around, and then decided to go dry out in one of the little bays off of a canal, South Belmore, West Wantagh.
Well, depends on what you're looking for. By cruise, calm water, it might be nice. The right person to be with you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Plus, you got to remember, you know, visibility is reduced at night, and you're running under navigation lights and stuff like that. So, and plus, this was the maiden voyage this year, so I didn't think a nighttime maiden voyage was as warranted as a daytime maiden voyage.
Much better off of having the shakedown cruise during daylight hours.
Not that I anticipated any problems, and we didn't have any at all. She ran like a top. But, you know, you always want to stack your cards and hedge your bets and be like a boy scout, all prepared.
This is true. Rather be safe than sorry if you want to add another euphemism.
There's a trooper hiding in the center median, facing the westbound traffic where the four-laner turns into the three-laner.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks for the heads up. I haven't gotten that far. I'm still on the Meadowbrook.
Yeah, he's like real tucked into the trees. You can't even see him. I don't know what he's doing. He might just be hanging out because he didn't look like he had a good shot at bidaring anybody, but like, whoa, there's a troop car over there.
Well, he might be taking a nap.
You pass him, you make note of what he's doing.
How about this? I'll bring the speed up to about 80 and see if he comes out of the bushes.
I know you would never do that, but traffic is moving well enough that you don't have to bring it up to 80. And to PPN Mobile, by the way.
And to ZDB Mobile. Yeah, I'm not that adventurous. I don't want to test my face. Bad enough that I've gone past troopers and looked down and said, ooh, I'm a little bit fast. And then looked up in my mirror to see if any red lights come on.
Oh, as long as you don't see the red lights, I guess that's good.
Haven't seen those in many, 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 many years.
Law of averages, my son.
Oh, well, I try to keep it so that even if I run right through their radar or LIDAR, whatever you want to call it, I don't get the cause to stop me.
I guess not. But anyway, Skeevy was out east all weekend long. I was, you know, tinkering and doing stuff, so now it's summer's in full swing.
full swing. I got Saturday to catch up on everything I wanted to catch up on, but my wife went with her girlfriend to the ballet, so I had the house all to myself.
It's you pirouetting and plieing all over the house in your tidy whities.
Yeah, I sat down at my computer for part of the day, catching up on all the paperwork. Second half, while she was out, I put on Netflix and watched a movie.